Alrighty, I can see that our friend Jakub is already there. Dobro rano. Dzień dobry.
Dobro rano.
Hello, hello. Do you hear me fine?
Perfectly fine. Loud and clear, Jakub. Good to have you.
Perfect.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Very good. Happy to be here with you.
Absolutely. I mean, just for the audience, Jakub Janda, many of you will have read already what he has published because he has been prolific in terms of dissecting what happens in recent years in what is the main topic for us today, and that is influence operations, disinformation, propaganda, and hybrid warfare. Jakub is the director of the Czech think tank, European Value Center for Security Policy, and is taking this all with both sincerity, seriousness, and a lot of humor from time to time, because sometimes you have to laugh at the Russians and what they do. Jakub, thank you very much for joining us today. Diki Motz, it's a real pleasure. It's the first time here for you, but our audience is global. As Jana will have told you, we've had numerous guests who've been hitting in the same curve, whether it is Jonathan Fink or beforehand, a long time ago, Thomas Reed. We've been discussing the impact of the Russian propaganda machine, their active measures, their constant efforts to test us and tease us out. A few years ago, when the Czech Republic actually expelled a vast amount of the Russian embassy's staff and people in close proximity to them, many in Europe were aghast. And how could they do so? Same thing happened when some of the Baltic states, even preceding the full-scale attack and full-scale invasion of Russia into Ukraine, reduced embassy personnel. Can you tell us a little bit as to how the Czech Republic came to do so and what impact did it have?
Mm-hmm. Definitely. So actually, the case you are referring to actually happened almost exactly 3 years ago. And so this particular case happened that actually in 2014 and 2015, there were actually a series of explosions in some of the ammunition storages on the Czech soil. During that time, in 2014, it was unclear why it happened. It was considered to be an accident. But in later years, there were joint investigations by multiple European security agencies, mainly the British and other ones, which actually connected the dots and connected the attacks or the explosions, in this case in Czech Republic, but also in Bulgaria, for example, to the Russian military intelligence agency, GRU. And after this was connected, so basically what happened 3 years ago was that Czech police and Czech intelligence agencies got the full picture, and they actually had convincing evidence, which they have shown to the Czech government, which acted very promptly and actually expelled, I think, something like 2/3 of the Russian embassy staff, which was, I think, something like 70+ people leaving Czech Republic, or being forced out of the Czech Republic, which was a major case, not only symbolically, but very practically. It actually meant that effectively large portions of Russian espionage are used or using Russian diplomatic cover was pretty much damaged or crippled, which is very relevant because, as you could imagine, in this case, the Russian embassies obviously serve as bases or safe havens for Russian intelligence, but not only in the local context. So usually they operate cross-border, where it's much harder to actually against Germany, or mainly against Germany, from the Czech soil. So pretty much Czech Republic kicking out those approximately 2/3 of Russian spies actually meant that we have protected ourselves, but pretty much in this case, mainly Germany, which has been the primary target of this Russian intelligence base operating out of Czechia. So that's come sometimes, let's say, how it's interconnected in the European security field.
Absolutely. And the same thing obviously also applies to the freedom of movement of these diplomats and the ease of access to Bratislava, for example, where during pretty much all previous governments of the last...
Do you hear me well? I don't hear you now.
I can hear you. Jakub, thank you very much. I apologize. And as Jenny just quite rightly said, we are so happy that it's such a stable affair on Twitter. But then again, it has been for quite a while. We're much privileged that we have it as it is. So when you just described the impact this has had mm-hmm. on the freedom of movement of Russian diplomats, and therefore, obviously, their intention to all across Central Eastern Europe, but specifically looking at Germany, trying to capitalize on the proximity to Germany and trying to suss out more industrial secrets as well as influence society in Germany. Can you also highlight what the difference was between the approach the Czech Republic had and the Czech society viewed it as such vis-a-vis the Slovak reaction? Because the access to Bratislava was quite clear, and as we found out right at the beginning of the full-scale invasion, Russian diplomats, cultural attachés, as they called themselves, were still negotiating with then Slovak politicians as to how not to assist Ukraine.
Yes, so pretty much you could say, and we could compare how the societies of Czechia and Slovakia actually view Russia. Unfortunately, long-term polling can show us that in Slovakia, the support for Russia and the opposition to the United States or to NATO is unfortunately very high in Slovakia compared to the Czech case. But nevertheless, until recently, Slovakia had a very, let's say, pro-NATO, pro-Ukraine president. I mean, still has. She is just finishing her term now. But although the government, the previous government of Slovakia, previous two governments, you could say, were actually very much supportive of Ukraine themselves. But unfortunately, they lost the elections. And currently, who we have in Slovakia is pretty much a very Russia-supporting prime minister, Mr. Robert Fico, who is actually openly, I would say, hugging the Russian ambassador. Those are symbolic actions publicly. But we do expect, actually, Russian intelligence to use Slovakia as a safe space, say, or safe ground, similar how Hungary or Austria pretty much are open to Russian espionage against other countries. And I'm afraid Slovakia is joining this pack now. And that's why, for example, you could hear actually Czech intelligence leaders, for example, saying sometimes publicly, sometimes privately, that they are not going to be sharing anything really sensitive related to Russia with their Slovak counterparts. Because when you have a prime minister who is so, so openly supporting Russia, such as the Slovak one, that's unfortunately something what actually corrupts or compromises any trust between the allies. We have already seen, for example, Czech Prime Minister refusing to share specific information with Slovakia about the ammunition initiative, which Czech Republic is now leading, trying to buy artillery ammunition for Ukraine. But Czech government decided not to share some of more sensitive details about it with the Slovak government, the current Slovak government, because of these reasons.
But it is obviously still terribly difficult, given the fact that there's so much integration, especially in the weapon system industry. One of the things where obviously we see, historic continuity in the terms of the heavy industry build-out in Slovakia, especially after the Second World War, and of course the long-standing tradition of the Czech weapon systems industry. There's a lot of integration between the two countries in that regard. And since the investment of USC and Kozice, this has improved even further in terms of quality. So it will be very difficult if you involve, shall we say, in this case, Czech/Slovak or companies which act in both countries in the weapons systems procurement to not have them infiltrated, right? I mean, these are risks which the Czech Republic and we as members of the coalition would have to take, correct?
It is, to some extent, it's happening. There are Slovak companies involved in providing weapons to Ukraine. That's definitely happening. In many cases, it's fine and can be going without any issues. But for example, there is, let's say, two kinds of information I could imagine which are not being shared with Slovakia now. One, which is specific intelligence related to Russia. So for example, either when Czech intelligence, civilian or military intelligence agencies have knowledge about Russian operations, they do not want them to share them with Slovakia or Slovak counterparts, because they know this information could easily be given back to Russia, as it is the case with Austrian or Hungarian intelligence agencies and their political leaders. So that's pretty much on the intelligence information related to Russia. The second type of information related, for example, example, to the current ammunition initiative, pretty much what's happening is that Czech government is going around the world, outside of Europe mainly, trying to basically locate and negotiate for large portions of artillery shells, so ammunition for Ukraine. The sensitive thing here is that those ammunitions are available in countries which are usually not supportive of Ukraine or are, for example, have links to Russia and China. So, for example, so these negotiations are very sensitive, and that's why you don't want Russia to know about them as they are happening, because Russia or China can basically squeeze or sabotage those countries to not do it, not to sell the ammunition to Ukraine. So this kind of information is exactly what you don't want Russia to have, and that's why you cannot give it to Slovak government currently.
And the issue is then that companies such as CSG, obviously, when they develop their radar technology and their anti-air defense capability further, and they are very much at the forefront of good development, they will be limited in what they can share in-house at this point in time. I'll take it that your colleagues on the other side of the fence in the Czech Republic will have this in hand, right?
I would assume so, yes. There are safeguards to protect it. But given the fact that Slovakia is still a part of EU and NATO, it's quite hard to actually limit anything formally. When we talk, for example, about export licensing, because every military material which goes outside of Czech Republic needs to get approval from the government, called the export licensing. So, for example, in this case, that's where it might become more tricky. But the specific knowledge sharing is obviously very arbitrary, or could be really decided by individual agencies or companies as well.
But you also would agree that it's highly unlikely that the Czech Republic would let itself to be stymied by restrictions that the Fico government would try to impose on exports of goods which have Slovak local content as part of the joint production, right?
It could be. So at this moment, the Slovak government is, allowing private companies to sell weapons or ammunition to Ukraine. So the export licensing from Slovakia is still up and running. What is not happening is that Slovak government, Slovak military, is actually not providing anything directly to Ukraine in this case. That's the current position of the Slovak government. But for the companies, it seems to be up and running. The other issue is that most of the Slovak companies are relatively small compared to others in the region, and much of their stocks have already been depleted or sold or given already. So it's not like a major issue at this moment, as far as I understand it.
All right. No, that makes a lot of sense. Now, let's reel back to what happened most recently, because I would like to close out that part, and it's also a stepping stone to the next part. Recent attacks on infrastructure, weapons manufacturers, as we just reeled back to what we have as experience from the past, from Bulgaria and from the Czech Republic, by GRU sources. But now we have more and more spies detected in Belgium, in Germany, in Poland, on various different levels. Some people declare it as being the tip of the iceberg, and it's probably not far off. But at the same time, the nature of these different spies, respectively gullibles or corrupted or agent provocateurs, is very different. Some are dedicated to infiltrating military establishments, trying to suss out information, collate information. Others are there to corrupt other individuals, try to politically gain political influence, see Belgium. And then there is the most recent of Pavel K. in Poland, where somebody was supposedly contracted to assassinate a traveling president. How do you see the panoply of the Russian infiltration in Europe making headway in us detecting them?
It's definitely part of the Russian war efforts. Russia currently is on a war footing, definitely in the industry domain, definitely inside of Ukraine at this moment. But we also see Russia preparing for open war with other European NATO member states. Russia is definitely preparing for it as much as it can. We obviously all hope that it will not trigger an open war with NATO countries, but we can definitely see Russia preparing for it. And some of these preparations on the Russian side are internal. So you could see basically, for example, formation of new units or new military districts around the neighborhood of Finland, for example, or restructuring some of the Russian army structures. That's all happening internally, let's say, in Russia. But also externally, we could see the what we call the pre-conflict or pre-war preparations on the Russian side. Some of it is trying to basically build political influence through influence operations, so sometimes online, sometimes only offline, such as basically bribing politicians, as, for example, the Czech Counterintelligence Agency have just exposed recently in Prague for basically Russian intelligence bribing multiple European politicians from multiple countries. So that's more like Russia trying to buy political influence and paralyze the political reaction of European countries to the Russian war. But also these, let's say, more military-oriented operations, such as mapping of storages, mapping of infrastructure, of communication nodes as well. That's definitely what Russia is doing. And I would say there is a quite a high level of alertness or alarm among European NATO member states that this is happening. The amount of it is I would say, it's not paralyzing, but it's, let's say, crippling. It's pretty much breathtaking to some extent, because that's how preparations for real war actually look like. And if Russia decides to actually have open some level of the hot conflict with NATO member states, those would be one of the tools, such as, for example, blowing up either communication nodes or assassinating political leaders, or, for example, sabotaging some of the material bases. So, for example, storages of ammunitions in some places. That's exactly how Russia would operate. We have seen Russia do this inside of Ukraine for quite a long time. So far, only selectively inside of NATO countries, but definitely Russia is getting ready to do it if it decides to launch the conflict against NATO countries.
Well, that's the thing, and well, those like me who remember their Cold War and lived through it also remember that we had a different level of preparedness and alertness at that point in time. That does not mean that we weren't infiltrated. Yes, of course, Western societies specifically were infiltrated. Germany was a very, very decent target in that regard, but other societies just as well. Western Europe was always constantly under attack since the Second World War panned out and the Russians immediately turned around to try to usurp the West. This is nothing new. This is an ongoing strategy. It's just interesting that we have completely failed to adapt to the fact that whilst they may have been lying lower in the 1990s out of sheer desperation and lack of funding, that does not mean that they've ever ended their quest. This brings us back to Ben Hodges, who said that acknowledging a threat means you're obliged to do something about it. We have multiple speeds in European societies addressing the perception of risk and what to do about it. What would you expect? What is a rational and reasonable expectation for the rest of the year with ongoing shocks coming left, right, and center for how Europeans will react to the effective threat of Russia towards Western democracies?
Well, what do I expect to happen is that it looks like that Ukraine is slowly losing some of its ground, unfortunately. At the same time, we see the pretty much a lack of push for like push for support from major Western European countries. We see a lot of talk, but quite little action. And so, to give you an example, Czech Republic has announced that we are close to buying almost 1 million artillery shells globally, and we still don't have enough money to pay for it, despite the fact that this amount of money is actually not very huge for example, richer Western European countries. So that only shows you the lack of political will. which to my understanding pretty much comes from lack of understanding how big the threat is, pretty much. Because the difference is, if I put it in a very simplified way, is that Central and Eastern European nations are pretty much scared of Russia, because we have not only our history, but we are really pretty much the Russian targets, and could be the Russian targets in single years, so very soon, if Russia decides for it. While much of Western and Southern Europe is actually not afraid of Russia. They dislike what Russia is doing. That's pretty much happening. That's nice. But we do not see a scare. We don't see as a fear of these countries from how open Russian war against European NATO countries would look like. And that's the reason why the real support for Ukraine, I mean the material, financial, military support, is actually very limited. And that's one of the key reasons why Ukraine is losing its ground, because it's pretty much missing on material support. That's the core of our problem now. And unfortunately has been, and I'm afraid it will be in the future. So I could imagine this to be a major trend. The big question is, how will the US election end up as well? What will be the final result? Whether it will be Trump or Biden being elected. But this is unfortunately one of the major trends. And that's why there are countries, at least in center and Northern Europe, you could say. So pretty much Baltic, Scandinavian countries, Poland, Czech Republic, and Romania are pretty much preparing very extensively for a possible high-intensity conflict with Russia. And that's why you see the military leaders of our region pretty much saying openly, the war is coming. We hope it will not be started by Russia, but we see Russia really preparing for it, and we are not ready on the European side. So that's what I could see. Yeah.
Would you see, therefore, that the Czech Republic, despite it being right bang in the middle of Europe, I mean, it is as just like Germany, it is as center as it goes. But would you expect that the Czech Republic would therefore decide to join the JEF, the Joint Expeditionary Force concept created by the British with allies all across Northern Europe?
I would expect that as well. Definitely Czech Republic tries to be, and our military tries to be, on the forefront. We currently have Czech military deployments in Latvia, Lithuania, and Slovakia, where we have people on the ground in NATO battle group formations. Czech Republic is also regularly, sending its air force for air policing, sometimes of the Baltic countries, sometimes of the island as well, and currently of Slovakia too. So that's definitely happening, and I would expect Czech Republic to do it if there would be the case as well.
Yeah, we've had your pilots here in the region a couple of times, and very, very decent chaps. Always good to see them flying all across. I mean, the three countries here are evidently too small, quite literally, to have their own air force. But we're very, I think everybody here is very lucky and also very appreciative of the efforts of everybody who does Baltic air policing in that regard. Now, when I asked about the JEF, it's obviously because it is NATO states, but together under one different, a different appreciation of risk seemingly unifies them. As you just highlighted, the Central European states do harbor fears. Now, Western Europe does not necessarily enjoy that fear or has that fear. Failing that, how could we nevertheless change the perception of risk in Europe better? Because that evidently European elites, while some of them may have woken up, they're not really there yet. What can we do to make them understand this better?
Good question. And honestly, I'm not really sure, because we are currently at the closest moment to World War III since approximately the 80s, let's say, or depends on you. Some people say 60s, some 80s, depends how you measure it. But pretty much we are there. We are at least for many decades, we are closest to really a global conflict, which does include a nuclear weapons state, unfortunately, as our enemy. So the stakes are really high. High, I mean, I can't really imagine how higher it could get. I'm afraid if, and I'm saying if, the Ukrainian defenses would be partially collapsing, for example, in upcoming, let's say, 6 to 12 months. So if this would be happening, there would be, for example, a huge migration wave or a refugee wave, I'm sorry, of multiple millions of Ukrainians refugees literally escaping from Ukraine to Center and Western Europe as well. That would be definitely coming. That's very organic. People would be running away from the Russian terrorists. So that would be one thing to be seen possibly if this goes through. The other thing which is very relevant is that I would say it's mainly about, at the end, it's pretty much about the political leadership at the national level, because we could have a couple of nice speeches by the French president, you know, a couple of nice tweets by the German chancellor. Those things are good, but if they are not followed by a particular action, that doesn't really change the political situation on the ground in our countries, because the problem really is not only some individual politicians and their lack of action, but pretty much that their populations don't really understand what's at stake, how big the threat is, and not only to like particular, that you could say, smaller countries in the east, in the eyes of, for example, German and French voters, but in the case of like a real all of European security, which would really be crippled, and not only in military sense, but also in the economic sense. That's something what pretty much hurts the voters as well, or would hurt the voters, but almost nobody is explaining it in mainly Western and South European nations, that this is exactly what's at stake. And if we don't help Ukraine to defend itself now, pretty much this kind of cascade effect, like a sequence of events, will there's almost nothing that could stop it after that. Meaning the huge refugee wave from Ukraine, possible Russian attacks against the weaker member states of NATO in Eastern Europe. So this is exactly like a chain of events which would be pretty much crippling for even like the prosperity of much of Europe as well, if you just exclude the military situation.
Now, evidently, we do have capabilities to fight, and we have better capabilities than the Russians have. Our air power, I mean, this is one of the things which currently Ukraine is denied in its fight against Russia, that is Western air power. Typically, we literally obliterate the enemies and the adversaries on battlefields by means of doing exactly that, using both naval aviation and, say, Air Force capabilities with long-range missiles to take out the enemy. Should Russia ever dare to engage in conflict, we would have to act with this, and we would probably be able to do so. Nevertheless, you're right, if you paint the picture correctly, and I think you do, in regards to what happens to the civilian population, the refugee streams, the economic disruption of such, say, an extended conflict, if Russia were to subdue Ukraine and force on its own terms, say, an occupation and creating a rump state and all these kind of terrible scenarios, evidently it would, say, put Europe at risk. And the Russians, from their perspective, would definitely employ their salami tactic, right? They would first try to consolidate, let the crisis simmer, let the economic impact disrupt Europe, threaten further, and then attack, because they need to gather steam first and foremost. It's not something which they would continuously do, even if they have a momentum, because they may not have the capacity. But still, all of these things could have been deterred. Now they have to be defended against. Both Mick Ryan, General Mick Ryan, as well as Ben Hodges said it, and a few years ago, Philip Breedlove, former SACUA, said it. If the enemy is at war with you, it doesn't matter what you think you are at. Or Ben Hodges recently said, Russia is at war with us. We need to accept that. Nobody in the political debate in Europe still accepts that. Mr. Scholz, Monsieur Macron, they see the risk and they differentiate, and they have now different stances. But if you look, and you will see this in the Czech Republic, if you watch the debate in Austria, in Germany, even in the Netherlands and in France, the public debate, if and when it touches upon Ukraine, is very balanced still. There are still loads and loads of people who say, oh, no, we should talk about peace. And why don't we exhaust more diplomatic avenues? And we are not at war. Nobody acknowledges that we are already facing a nation at war with us.
Yeah, no, definitely it is happening. I think where it leads to is that there is basically a coalition of like-minded countries which understand where we are and are really preparing for a defensive war. And that's pretty much, you could say, the Scandinavian countries, Baltic nations, Poland, Czechia, Romania, maybe a couple of other ones. I mean, if I'm speaking about this eastern flank, we definitely see Austria, Hungary, and now Slovakia pretty much being on the Russian side or so, pretending to be in the middle, but pretty much going towards the Russian dream to some extent, unfortunately. And then we see all these reluctant countries like Germany, France, Italy, Spain, which are actually doing very little. I mean, some things are good which they do, but in general, they are not really preparing us for a defensive war or themselves. So that's something what is actually very, very, I would say, terrifying. And that's why countries in our region, in Central Eastern Europe, are actually thinking, well, we will definitely be EU and NATO members for the future, but we can't really rely on our Western European allies. We see how out of reality they are at this moment, and for long, unfortunately, not only now. So the only option is pretty much to prepare ourselves. And that's why you see such huge military buildups by countries like Poland, for example, because they pretty much strategically understand they can't really rely on anybody from Western Europe in a strategic sense if Russia attacks. We can hope, but we cannot really put all of our weights in this basket. So that's pretty much what I could see happening now.
All righty. Jakub, we have a couple of hands up from our audience. First and foremost, let's go to my friend and colleague Jana, and then afterwards we'll go to Ralph from Baku. But Jana, please.
Thank you very much, both. Jakub, it's so wonderful to have you. Well, my question is a little bit towards the hybrid warfare, because to my amazement, you have been really banging the drum about the security risks and disinformation and hybrid warfare coming from Russia and other foreign powers for years and years and years. First of all, it must have been very frustrating, because I think a lot of societies have been really sleepwalking. But my question is, do you see evolvement? How do you see this hybrid warfare have been changing throughout the years? Can you tell us about that? Thank you.
Thank you for the question. I honestly don't see that many changes because it's quite successful. If you look at how Russia and China are actually conducting hybrid warfare and for interference, the tactics are quite similar. I mean, each has different ones, but pretty much there are no major changes in last approximately 5 years. The only real change is that China actually adopted the other approach, which is pretty much luring mainly Western European companies to China to make sure that the economic dependencies of Europe on China is so big that when China decides to take any action against Taiwan or the Philippines or Japan, Europe will do nothing. You will not sanction heavily China as we should, because European economic dependencies will be so large, and the largest businesses or corporations from mainly Germany, France, and Spain will actually be squeezing their national leaders to do nothing, meaning not to sanction China in a way of sectoral sanctions like we have done on Russia now. So that's exactly what we see China doing as a major effort, or one of the main efforts of hybrid interference in European societies. We see almost no pushback against that in Western European countries. I would say it's strategically stupid, because it's very clear where China is going for it or why is it doing it. Similarly to how Russia used energy diplomacy tools in the past against European countries. Fortunately, they were very successful. I mean, if you remember how Nord Stream 2 was working out, pretty much as a tool of political strategic influence for Russia in Europe, it was amazing. amazing how many politicians got actually corrupted by it across multiple nations, not only Germany. But fortunately, this is gone because of the Russian war. But this is exactly how it's been done by Russia, and very successfully in building political influence in business and political establishments of particular countries.
Thank you.
Yes. Let's go to Baku to our colleague Ralph. Ralph, you had a question.
Thank you, Axel. Good to see you, and good to see you, Jakub from Czech Republic. It's a big hello. Have a good day, everyone, from Sunshine Caspian Sea, from Baku, Azerbaijan. I have a question, Jakub. I see that Mr. Petr Pavel initiatives, Czech government and the Czech president fully behind and support Ukraine as a, for example, we know that 1 million artillery shells initiative by Czech Republic before, it's a very important support by U.S. We see that what's happening in the U.S. Congress, still U.S. not any help enough for U.S. But it's a specific question that is a two-part of question. First question is, what do you think that is, for example, Czech and the Slovakia foreign policy? What do you think? And before, we know that Czechoslovakia, Slovakia and the Czech Republic united country now is a separate country, but for example Slovakia government policy fully supports Russia. We see that how FICO support Russia, but Czech Republic policy is very different. And the second question is, what do you think that Eastern Europe policy after Russia war against Ukraine? Thank you.
Thank you for the question. I would say that definitely they are diverging political positions of Czech and Slovak governments. That's why you saw also a dispute between Czech Republic and Slovakia now, where, for example, Czech government decided to suspend the, let's say, joint meetings of Czech and Slovak governments, which have been done for a long time. But now there are so many disagreements over Russia policy or Ukraine policy as well, that the governments do not want to meet. On the Czech government said they don't trust the Slovak one, so they don't want to meet them anymore in such format. That's why I would say that you have, let's say, pretty much Czech government and the current Czech president as well are one of the strongest supporters of Ukraine. I mean, not only politically, but also with similar material initiatives, such as the ammunition initiative, where Czech Republic is actually a global leader on this at this moment, buying artillery shells for Ukraine outside of Europe. That's pretty much what Czech government is doing, and I think it's quite good. While you see what the Slovak government is doing, which is openly hugging the Russian ambassador, Slovak foreign minister, you know, taking smiling pictures with the Russian foreign minister, and actually Slovak prime minister pretty much repeating the Russian disinformation as it's stated by the Russian Federation. So that's something where the differences are huge. Obviously, a large portion of the Slovak population doesn't agree with that, which is good, but still the threat is here, and it's quite visible.
All righty. Let's move on to Stephen, and then we go back to my colleague Ming.
Many thanks. Jakub, very much appreciated all of your many efforts over the years. Also, I want to congratulate Czechia, Czech Republic, for becoming now, as I see it, quite honestly, the leaders of the free world. Your recent actions in military support for Ukraine, very creative ones, but also your counterintelligence and counterinfluence operations have been absolutely stellar and have been putting everyone else in the free world to shame. So my question is, I also just wanted to say I have always admired Czech arms, and in fact, my very first rifle was a Bruno, still my favorite. Anyway, I would like to ask your opinion, given your recent excellent counterintelligence and counterinfluence operations, whether you feel that other nations, it's a two-part question. Firstly, whether you feel that other nations in Europe and the rest of the free world are adequately stepping up in the same kind of way. That's the first part of the question. Second part of the question is, do you feel that Russian efforts in the opposite direction are equally stepping up and is the problem getting worse, in other words? Thank you.
Thank you for the question. I would say the problem is getting worse because Russia is pretty much on a war footing, not only as industry, but also as their intelligence agencies. So they are extremely active in Europe. I mean, the good news is that there is not that many cover places. So basically, Russian diplomatic posts in Europe has been diminished across in the last 2 years, which is good news. But their use of illegal, so people without the diplomatic passports, is actually very big in Europe. And that's what's scaring people the most, because they are the hardest ones to track down, unlike those operating out of embassies and consulates. So that's definitely happening much more. I don't myself know the full scope of it, definitely, but definitely the trend is going up. Whether other Europeans are doing similar, well, some are and some are not, but... So, for example, you could now see how the Czech Country Intelligence Agency actually exposed this network of, I think, approximately six or politicians from six European nations basically getting bribes by Russian intelligence for supporting Russia in the European Parliament elections, including, for example, the Alternative for Germany, the far-right party of Germany, which has been very much exposed in this. But just to give an example where we don't see enough of urgency of action is that Czech diplomacy is actually pushing for almost half a year from now for a new initiative which would actually force the Russian diplomats across Europe to actually have biometric passports, so they cannot basically be using the cover identities, or you could say fake identities, that much, and they would be actually have tougher time to travel across European countries, because as you know, we have the Schengen area, so pretty much there are no ground border controls in most European countries now, which is great for civilians, for citizens, but for Russian intelligence, this is a great way how to actually have Russian intelligence officers and a diplomatic cover to travel without anybody checking, pretty much, because there are no ground border controls. So one of the efforts of the Czech government now is to change the rules for Russian diplomats across Europe. So they have to be confined to one particular country to which they are attached to which they are accredited to. Plus, they would have to have the biometric passport with all their biometric data in that, which they don't have to have now in most countries. But we have not seen, for example, Germany or France supporting this initiative because they see it as too escalatory towards Russia, which to us is completely stupid. But because of these disagreements inside of the European family, we don't have such, I would say, very protective and defensive measures, such as these mandatory diplomatic passports for Russian diplomats and intelligence officers under the diplomatic cover. So this is just an example of where we are missing out still.
All righty, Ming, please.
Thanks, Axel. Jakob, lovely to talk to you. I have to say, one of my formative experiences in my youth was in your country. So back in 1989, I was in March, on the 15th of March, 1989, I was at a demonstration in Budapest alongside Mr. Orban and Fidesz. And then in November, December 89, I was in Wenceslas Square shouting Havel Narod doing all those sorts of good things, hopefully. So my question is, what was the political dynamic that leads Mr. Orban to where he is today, and to a lesser degree, the Slovaks? And what is it the Czechs did right?
Yeah, good question. Thank you. I mean, we have the social dynamics are quite similar in the region, but the political dynamics of individual politicians are sometimes different. We have politicians who had a similar track record, like Mr. Orban in Czech Republic as well. Those who were pretty much started as, let's say, pro-Western, pro-NATO liberals and ended up as pretty much corrupt puppets of Russia and China, such as Mr. Orban is now. So the trends are different. But in the case of Viktor Orban, you could clearly see how he basically two things. One, domestically, he basically wants to be a domestic dictator who hates media, NGOs, any kind of opposition. So he's trying to dissolve any liberal democratic mechanisms for having like a balance of power, rule of law, and the usual things. So that's what he's doing domestically. But internationally, pretty much he sees or he really would like to expand the borders of Hungary, which might sound weird and completely strange, but if you see and look how he is talking about this in the last 10 years, this seems to be one of his core political agendas to do, not just physically to move the borders, that might be a big dream for the future, but for example, expand the influence of Hungary to neighboring countries where they are Hungarian-speaking communities, either in Slovakia, Romania, or for example, or in parts of Ukraine as well. So he's doing similar things which Russia has been doing as well in its neighborhood, which are completely hostile and contradictory to European security interests. At the same time, he sees Russia and China as his potential future donors, because he really believes that the European Union will fail. And if he is the best friend of Russia and China in Europe, he will get their support for anything he wants. This is, in a nutshell, what I believe is his core motivation. That's how he talks about it in some settings as well. And that's what is pretty scary, I have to say. That's why he's considered to be a traitor of European security. And he's acting like one in support of Russia, but also China, which is maybe not so visible, but it's happening too.
Ming, I think that we were both equally unhappy seeing Mr. Orban and a number of other people, especially after they replaced Gyurcsány, who was definitely very corrupt, with their government and then failed to actually act upon what they projected. But Jakub, as you just said, the cultural wedge issues, what the Russians have employed, say, comprehensively, now seen by Mr. Orban and his troop as being the only way for them to tie in to minorities which they deign to be not protected, which is rubbish if you think about it, given the fact that the Hungarian minority in Slovakia is not in any shape or form disenchanted or, say, impaired. Quite the contrary, a part of the EU, same thing happens in Romania. Nobody would ever deign to say that the Romanians are, say, impairing their Hungarian-speaking minorities. Quite the contrary, actually. These wedge issues are there in order for them to have more business ties into other regions and play up their role so that they can then take more money from, as you just rightly said, China and the likes. I thought that at some point in time in the 1990s, we had all agreed that we can overcome the wedge issues, the cultural wedge issues, by working collaboratively. We've projected this, but we've seemingly never really overcome this. Otherwise, they would not be so easily exploitable. What do you think? How should we do this in future? Because our suggestion, and Edward Hunter Christie and I have been writing about this, is that we need to make sure that we define some unity politics in one regard, not what the Americans always project as the unity party. No, but that there are certain elements of economics and national security, or in this case, European security, which are should be cordoned off from discussions where people try to exploit them for other purposes. This is what the Brits once had for quite some time. What do you think? How can we achieve that, that people feel that there is a value in defense and defending our own first and foremost before we go into divisive issues such as that?
I would say that it's quite clear that there is a block of basically evil dictatorships we are facing off. Russia, China, I mean, definitely Iran and North Korea are part of it as well. But mainly Russia and China as the big players for us as Europeans.
Krink.
So there's the...
Krink, you mean?
Yes,
the axis
yes,
of evil.
So they are, and in this sense, that's something what is what actually is uniting us, or should be uniting us, because otherwise we have no real chance how to let's say politically and economically survive in the upcoming world where we will be facing off. We are actually the strongest economic bloc in the world, but we are not using this economic power. We are not actually sanctioning China for the support of Russia as we should, because we are too afraid of Chinese economic retaliation, for example. So that's why we see China very strategically supporting the Russian war crimes in Ukraine with no pushback. We only have European politicians going to Beijing where they are kneeling and begging for dirty money contracts, such as the German chancellor or the French president or the Dutch prime minister recently as well. But we don't actually push, in this case, China to stop actually doing their strategic support for Russia, which is actually very, very visible and very large, let's say. So until we actually decide to put our weight, I mean, political and economic weight, behind the words we say.
Did we lose Jakub?
There we go. I think, Jakub, we have you back now.
1, 2, 3, 4, do you hear me?
Loud and clear.
We do.
Yes.
Okay, very good.
Ming, you had a comment. Maybe we can lead into that.
Yes, so it was a comment, and it's interesting how this is a comment on the revolutions of 1989. So back in 1989, the really hot political issue in the UK was something called Section 28. Right. And Section 28 was a proposal by Mrs. Thatcher's government to ban funding from councils supporting gay rights. Right. So this back then it was gay rights, not LGBTQT or whatever. But that was what we were all talking about in the US, in the UK. And then I went to Hungary and to Czechoslovakia. And, you know, it seemed so trivial in comparison with the issues that they were demonstrating about. You know, it was freedom or death, while we were trivially sort of arguing about, I suppose, tweaks to our own freedoms, you know. So that was the really formative part of my experience on those sorts of travels, and it was just, and the odd rhyme of history is that the same issue is being used by Mr. Orbán today. It's just so bizarre.
Yeah, I mean, I could see this happening. We could see a lot of efforts for basically these culture wars to be opened in some of European countries. Definitely there are wedge issues such as LGBTQ rights and others, but honestly they are not the primary concern for life and death of those countries. And more we see Russia opening up its war, I mean in Ukraine, but maybe about other countries, that starts to take precedence as the main issue, which is the defense of the country in a sense of what is coming up. So I think to some extent this will be changing.
Yeah, but I think Ming obviously has one point that the inversion of the wedge issues and the abuse by Russia of what are traditional wedge issues and reenactment of this is quite insidious. It's farcical given the fact that how liberal in that regard, especially Hungary, has been for many, many decades, if not hundreds of years. But having said this, Jakub, one more thing towards the end of our segment. In terms of the containment, what do you expect? Assume that aid is now released. The delays in delivery of ordnance changes. Administration and Republicans have recentered themselves. Let's just assume that they can do that. And belatedly, nevertheless, they deliver. They even deliver more attack-ems as opposed to previous hesitation by the administration. All of that being said, they are relatively late with it. Ukraine has an existential fight, which has become much harder than it should have been. And they may have to give ground. This may impact how Europeans perceive this during the year. And you indicated this earlier. But beyond whatever happens in the elections, at the same time, the Europeans, whenever there is a further obstacle in Ukraine and more atrocities are committed, they are forced to reconcile with the mirror image of their actions. Don't you think that the Europeans, that there's a glimmer of hope that the Europeans will finally get there? Because before it was a bit gloomy and doomy. I'm just wondering, don't you think that they will wake up?
I hope we would, but I'm more skeptical. Because the time is running out, really. And even if there is like a political decision, like, for example, if it happens even tomorrow in the Congress, that's great. But those things, before they start arriving in Ukraine, it will take multiple months. The package which US will hopefully approve, that's good and big. But it's, again, only a short-term solution for a couple of months. And it will be extremely hard in the US pre-election context in the summer or fall to actually do something like that again in much bigger way as it will be needed. So that's why I'm skeptical. I'm happy it's go forward now, but I'm quite skeptical about it. And on the European context, the decisions we should have taken 2 years ago, pretty much setting up new factories to build or produce ammunition, for example, and weapons. If we did these decisions 2 years ago, approximately today, the production will be up and running and Ukraine could be getting it. But if we basically decide in European capitals that we will finally put the real money behind our wars, so pretty much put it in the defense industry now, it will not bring any battlefield advantage to Ukraine for many months, because just having the money physically doesn't give you ammunition on the battleground tomorrow. And that's our problem, the timeline. So I hope that, we will get as much as possible. But for example, the Great Czech Ammunition Initiative, I'm happy it goes forward and it's great. But the problem is that it's pretty much just the emergency mechanism, because we are unable of having the ammunition across Europe. So that's why basically Czech government is now begging globally for anybody to have ammunition, which we could give Ukraine right now. So it's pretty much kind of an emergency mechanism, emergency tool, how to save a couple of months at least in the Ukraine defenses, but it's not a long-term solution. So that's why I'm skeptical.
It's a bridge,
and many of the Ukraine defenders are.
And Jakub, yeah. I agree with you. It is a bridge, but at the same time, it also faces significant operational logistical challenges. As we understand, is that when you try to harness, global market of old inventory of ammunition, you end up with quality management issues. And I understand from friends in the Czech Republic that this has already been the case. So it is vitally important that the inventories which we do have, and there's only one larger 155 inventory that is in the United States, unfortunately, respected in their pre-positioned stock, are used in that regard. Which brings me to the last point, that is the economic aspect. And we've been discussing this here in very much detail over the recent 2 years, that the weapon system industry, right in the 3 days, and to give you one example, which is absolutely terrifying if you think about it, 3 days after the full-scale invasion, 282 German weapon system manufacturers, which means they're not just German, many of them are evidently fully integrated across Europe, and there's a number of, by the way, Czech companies integrated with that just as well, of course, offered to the German government a list of inventories and highlighted the capabilities for short-term scaling up of production and what could be procured in what stream, and what kind of capabilities they could foresee to be brought forward within 9 months. The German government literally let it slide for a long, long time, projecting great changes and doing nothing. As you said earlier, a little less talk, a little more action, in the good old words of Elvis Presley. We have the capabilities. We can scale. There's even things which we can do reasonably quickly if we want to. But the political will means that we actually tell our industry, A, there will be orders, because we've educated the industry for such a long time that they're dependent on orders. Nobody's producing on spec anymore. The head of Diehl, who just visited Ukraine 2 days ago stated that they will, now that they have orders, produce more IRIS-Ts and that they will deliver them. But we're delivering very small numbers. The small numbers is the key thing. The Czech Republic has always had this wonderful, say, vertically integrated weapon system industry, has been doing so very, very well also since freeing itself from the Soviet yoke. What is it that prevents us from integrating this better? What is it other than the political will? Is it the fact that we fail to acknowledge that we need to produce fewer cars and we can simply actually utilize some of our factory capacities for other things? Or is it really just the fact that everybody is staring at the politicians they voted for and the politicians stare back at the electorate and say, well, unless we poll you correctly, we're not going to move? Is it just that, or what should we expect to be the reason for that?
I would say the core of it is pretty much your lack of, understanding on the level of many of the European leaders, how deep the problem is. Most of the time, the military and the intelligence establishments across Europe have similar assessments. They have similar information, so they all understand the huge threat we are facing. The difference is, across the European capitals, how much do national political leaders actually listen to their own military intelligence leaders? That's pretty much the decision. More east you go, pretty much, there the understanding, the cooperation is deeper. More Western you go, it's not really there. So I would say that's the main difference which I could see.
So people should, if then that is true, then it ends up being a function of leadership breaking out from that mold. So we should all be a bit more like the Czech president, right?
I hope so. I think he's doing a great job in this.
All right, I can see that we have one more hand up from Norway, from our colleague Øyvind. And after that, I shall say that we should end our segment. Øyvind, please.
Yeah, one quick one. The value of one Leopard 2 tank, a new one, is equivalent with 38,000 kamikaze drones. So my question is, do Europe produce the right stuff? Thank you.
Good question. I don't have a clear answer, honestly. Pretty much modern militaries need each of these items, including main battle tanks and smaller drones as well. In a nutshell, our problem is lack of the production. So we have the lack of the capacity, so the amounts, the numbers of the factories we have across Europe for similar or different military items. That's the core of our problem. Because if you see it in Ukraine does not have the luxury of pretty much choosing. You cannot choose to have either tanks or the drones. You need to have both to survive. But our problem is really the capacity, the amounts which we are unable of producing as Europe as a whole at this moment.
See, now that we're coming to an India, you can see the hands are popping up. Our friend and colleague from Perth in Australia, Will Teal, please.
Thanks, Axel. Yeah, I mean, very interesting. Listen, Jakob, thanks very much. I've got what might seem a little bit more of a frivolous question, but it's serious nonetheless. From your perspective in Europe and seeing how effective Russian intelligence operations have been, essentially since the end of the Cold War, right? They never stopped. It carried on, it seems, as did China's. And with the advent of this current invasion in February 22, the whole emergence of, you know, the organic operation that what is NAFO to fight their disinformation and how effective it may or may not have been. I'd like to get your opinion on how effective you think NAFO has been at countering Russian disinformation, and might it be important for the European Union or NATO or somebody going forward after this war is over to even start now, to run something, maybe not something like NAFO, but essentially a fact-checking and information publishing agency to make sure that the facts and disinformation can be countered much more easily, because it's now being done in this organic situation with no funding. Now, of course, the enemies of NAFO all claim it's funded by the CIA, and that of course becomes part of our story that we abuse them with. But it's amazing to me that NAFO has been so successful, and I wonder if there might be a permanent role for something like a disinformation agency in the liberal democracies to counter what's still going on from Russia and China. Thank you.
Thank you for the question. I agree. Definitely, there's lack of funding, a lack of effort on the side of governments to do this. There are organic initiatives, as you mentioned, which are doing it, which is not enough, definitely, given the scope that we are facing, effectively, the Russian and Chinese disinformation machine on the governmental level. So we are really outpowered, let's say, in this case, or outfired, let's say. That's why that much more would need to be done. Very practically, more funding, more governments support. I doubt it would be done by governments directly in more open way. I think the civil society can do much better role in strategic communications in this field. In smaller countries like the Baltic nations, I think it's done quite extensively in cooperation between governments, militaries, and the civil society. But in larger countries, I don't see that that effort to be happening in such a scale. So I think that's what should be done in the future. Yeah.
All righty, Jakub, thank you very much for joining us today. I hope this was the start of a wonderful and hopefully repetitive, safe friendship with our space. We'd be delighted to have you back. And there's going to be also a number of panels in future where sometimes one of our guests, we bring them together. We had Jonathan Fink from Silicon Curtain, who is here on a regular basis, pretty much every week. Edward Hunter Christie and others, and we'd be delighted to having your voice as part of this.
Thank you. Happy to have you. Thank you very much.
Dikimots. Thank you very much. Everybody, please give a big hand to Jakub Janda.